KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
hey,
nerd.
Ray.
I'm a
paleo hello, David! How you doing?
Good, man. I'm doing really good. You know, it's been cold and
you said it's blowing
snowy.
Sideways today, or?
Yeah, you know, but last week it was, well, last 2 weeks it's been frozen. I've been shoveling a lot of snow, and then two nights ago it turned to rain, and now it's raining.
So we're obviously,
it is biblical, dude.
It's biblical, but we're obviously recording this in the height of the Ketchikan summer.
Yeah, when I say biblical, it means 40 days and 40 nights of rain, and it's no big deal
right,
here.
Right, yeah. All right, well.
Till I see the guy next door building an ark, then I'll
oh,
start
yeah,
worrying.
Right. Great fossil news. You know our most recent, one of our recent interviewees, Dean Lomax.
Yeah.
He is part of a discovery. They drained a reservoir in England.
Really?
And they found a 33-foot ichthyosaur.
Oh, I saw that in the Paleo News feed this morning.
Yeah, yeah,
in
yeah. And stupidly, the news calls it a sea dragon. Whoa.
Gotta get eyes on the story.
Yeah,
there.
Well, yeah. Anyway, 10 meters long. And it's one of the greatest fossilized finds in British paleontology.
Oh, really?
That's what they say. And Dean Lomax was part of it. This guy, listen to this. They drained a reservoir, kind of clean it out and stuff. And this guy notices these vertebra sticking out of the bottom. What is this? And then they start excavating. I love those finds. That's just so cool how it's just... is.
What
it,
are these things?
It's a happenstance, you know? It's just...
Well, that's jolly good news. But, you know, ichthyosaurs over in my neck of the woods are twice as big as
yeah,
that,
how
dude.
Big is that big one up there in Canada?
Well, the one in British Columbia was approaching 70 feet.
Oh, my goodness. So this is a baby.
You know, it's a baby, wee baby. But anyways, it's very cool. And good on Dean Lomax. He's yeah. in the story. You know, I mean... we're like, you know, swimming with the big fish.
I know,
dude,
and
you know?
We've
like,
got our bigger fish to fry.
News story, it's like one of our, oh man, today.
Yeah, and it takes place, and he's in England.
He's in Norwich.
He's
in Cromer, England. I looked it up, and he's at 53 degrees north, and I'm at 55 degrees north, so we might have
but
the same
But I believe
weather.
Cromer's in Norwich. It's
you
a
know,
shire,
England,
yeah, anyway.
Like,
Well,
you perform over there. Yeah. I have no clue. I've been to London.
Yeah, I've been all
once.
Over that gray slog of a beautiful country. So anyway, I never heard of him until you suggested him as a guest. Tell me about him, and let's get him on the line.
Get him on the line, yes. I can't do my British accent when you start doing the Australian accent. Henry G. He is one of the editors at Nature, which is the biggest scientific publication in the world, arguably, and they do argue about that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But Henry G. is a paleontologist, but he's really more of kind of an editor, really, in the science world.
Yeah.
And
he's
author. A cool guy and author of many, many books for the for guys like you and me.
Yeah.
And you and I have both been reading his latest one, and I absolutely
yeah,
love
it's
this
great.
Book.
And he is eloquent and exquisite in his quotes and the way he takes a very droll subject, which is billions of years of life history.
Well
droll to the average non-scientific, non-paleo person. He really just lightens up the history of life on this planet, and it's just fantastic.
Well, we're talking about the book, Very Short History of Life on
in
Earth.
In 12 pithy chapters.
And what does pithy mean?
I believe it's a Shakespearean. It means small.
Small, like very precise statements.
Oh, you've looked that up? Is that what it means?
Well, yeah, pithy.
Oh.
Have pithy on me,
no.
Will you, sir? It's different than pity, but pithy.
Okay,
but
anyway, you're getting off this. We need to call him up and get him on the line.
Let's get him on the line. I'm so excited. I dreamt about this. I'm really nervous to meet the guy, but it's going to be so much fun. Call him up, man. Hey, Dave, meet Henry G., British paleontologist and an evolutionary biologist. He's a prolific writer, a blues musician, Tolkienist, and senior editor of Biological Sciences at the scientific journal Nature. His latest popular book is A Very Short History of Life, 4.6 Billion Years in 12 Pithy Chapters. Henry, I am super excited to meet you. Welcome to the show and meet my buddy, David Strassman.
Hello.
Hey, Henry.
Hi, David. Hi, Ray.
Good to meet you. Exquisitely written. Exquisitely written.
Thank you. Hello, hello, David. Hello, Ray. Can I do a fanboy moment, please?
Sure, sure. Sure.
Right, here it comes. Here it comes. Okay. Squee! Right, done now.
Was that it? Right.
That was it.
Well, you know my work.
Yeah, I do. Very much. For a long time.
Thank you so much. In fact, you ran a review of my book, Rapture of the Deep, in Nature. So that's the only time I've ever really been in a big deal.
My God. Yeah, well, I bought Rapture of the Deep. Well, I've been a fan of your T-shirts for a long time, and I bought Rapture of the Deep at a paleo convention because I thought it looked just like the inside of my son's brain. So I saw Rapture of the Deep. Yeah, it's an enduring classic in the G household.
And I'm sitting here with a Mutual Admiration Society. Let me ask you this.
We'll knock it off.
Henry, are you a paleo nerd?
I am a paleo nerd.
Prove
I'm a card-carrying... Well, I haven't got any fossils in here. I've got a basket full of fossil echinoids in the next room.
Oh. Echinoids, I love it.
My earliest years was in southeast London, quite close to an old museum called the Horniman Museum, which is a marvellous old-fashioned museum, you know, the kind of museum that has a bit of everything. It has stuffed animals, totem poles, Egyptian mummies, skeletons... And my mum would say that she'd wheel me and in my stroller into the Horniman Museum, and I would insist on being parked in front of the most gory, grisly, scary dissections and Egyptian mummies and everything. But believe it or not, I mean, you guys will appreciate this, but... back in the mid-60s, dinosaurs were uncool. Dinosaurs were not really popular. This was before
the Bob Barker revolution.
So they.
That's in the UK, Henry. But go ahead.
Well, yeah. But when I was five, I was given this book, this kids' book. I've still got it. It's called The Look and Learn Book of the Wonders of Nature, book for kids. And it's got all sorts of amazing things in it, like, you know, geysers and hibernating bears. And
original book from when you were a child?
Yeah, that's the same one, an axolotl and a band. And there's nothing about dinosaurs in it. Now,
what?
A book like... I know, a book like that
but
now...
Maybe it's about contemporary nature, not about paleo.
No, there's something that Ray would appreciate, I've just found. there... A Long Way Home for the Salmon, a picture of salmon migration.
Yes.
And it does have a section on fossils. There they are, about fossils. There's an ichthyosaur, and there's some ammonites and a fossil leaf. And nothing at all about dinosaurs at all. There's a coelacanth.
Another
thing. So it all changed?
Well, on the back, this is the punchline. The back was... this picture. Now, your listeners can't see this picture, so I'll describe it. It's a kind of mashup of what paleo nerds will know as the Zeilinger or Age of Reptiles.
Yeah, mural. There seems to be the whole Mesozoic in there in one picture.
In just one picture. Now,
it's from
there
the
is
Peabody
no,
mural, yes.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know that at the time. But I didn't know what these creatures were.
Really?
Age five. Now, you know, kids these days know the names of 10 dinosaurs before they're potty trained. But I didn't know what they were. And there is no caption or legend in the book to explain what they are. They're just there.
So then they were tantalizing you. What are these, Mom?
They were.
But how did you go from that interest to wanting to know the difference between a cow and a Paleolithic wash basin?
Right, yeah. If I had a pound for every time anyone had made that joke, I'd have 874 pounds. But when I will come to that, because when I was five, my parents took me to the Natural History Museum in London, And there it all just clicked. That was wow. instantly my spiritual home. I saw the dinosaurs.
Oh, you did, all right.
Yeah, and they, it was just, you know, epiphany.
Was that your come to Darwin moment, as they say?
Yeah, yeah. But also, the thing that interested me more than the dinosaurs was the Hall of Fossil Fish.
Yes.
Now,
speaking my language.
It's like the electric banana. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore. And my good friend Per Ahlberg said, yeah, I was the other nerdy kid in that Hall of Fossil Fish because there was no one else. But I always liked the end nearest the beginning when people were trying to find out where fish came from. I was less interested in near the end with the more modern or Mesozoic, but it was the early stuff, where these things came from. But in the way, I've never left the Natural History Museum, and I had, you know, I went to the university in Leeds in Yorkshire, and I was going to do a PhD on fossil fish, but due to a miscalculation with funds and timing, I ended up doing with fossil cows. While I was still an undergraduate, I was very fortunate to get a vacation studentship at the Natural History Museum. This started when my professor at Leeds, who was a wonderful man, Robert McNeil Alexander, he's now passed, fantastic fellow. He was an expert on biomechanics, and he wrote books on paleontology and other things. And he asked me what I wanted to do with my life, and I said I wanted to be a vertebrate paleontologist, which I had no idea I wanted to be. It just slipped into my head at the time.
Yeah.
Now Neil leaned over and said, you realise there aren't many openings in that field. Now, right. I have to say, Neil was a tall, kindly man with a long white beard, and he was a kind of a cross between Gandalf, Professor Dumbledore, and Obi-Wan Kenobi, and possibly Rey.
Yes.
And he was trying to persuade me that this was not the droid I was looking for, but he said, there are these vacation studentships at the Natural History Museum. So to cut a long story slightly less long, they sent a lot of projects we could work on, and I decided to apply for the project that was the most obscure, and that was pteraspid fishes. So I got the job, and indeed I learned I had been the only applicant. And but then this was the early 80s, and I was working with Colin Patterson, Peter Forey, Brian Gardner, and of course, by extension, Don Rosen. I was working with the bad boys. I was working with the revolutionary cladists. Now, all the other people in the museum shunned them, and they used to drink at a different pub at lunchtime.
Those cladists will do that.
They drank at the Cladists' Arms. Don't look for that now either. That's now a posh brasserie or something. And Brian Gardner, who's also passed quite recently, Brian and Colin and Peter used to sink the most amazing amount of beer. And basically, they exerted a fascination on the young deuterostome that I was. These were mad, bad, and dangerous to know. They had an allure. So I worked on pteraspids, and I worked on from the old red sandstone.
And can you define a pteraspid for me?
A pteraspid is a kind of jawless fish about so big.
So Devonian?
Devonian, Silurian Devonian. Probably they were extinct by the end of the Devonian. Internally, they would have looked like a lamprey, but their front end was covered in a bony head shield.
Okay.
They had tail fins.
Yeah, there's one. Yeah, I know what that is.
They
had
tail fins, but they didn't have any other paired fins. They had long schnozzles, presumably.
So they were a swimming finger.
Yeah, they were armored, but Henry, let me just jump in here. So cool Paleozoic fishes, but then you took a turn into Ice Age bison in Britain, and you know, we Americans like to think that we own bisons.
Yeah.
But the Brits, you guys...
I got this grant to go to Cambridge to do Ice Age bison, and I thought, I really wanted to do fish, but being a cladist, I just realised that bittern were just highly derived fish, evolved for locomotion in water of negative depth.
That's one of my favorite quotes. I have
Is that what land is? So land is a water of negative depth.
Land is water of negative depth. Yeah.
If I can, I'm going to quote our guest here. Most vertebrates, even today, are fishes. With this perspective, the tetrapods, those vertebrates that have made the move onto land, can be seen as a rather strange group of fishes that have become adapted for living in water of negative depth. I love that. Thank you.
So that's what cladism does to you. It gives it kind of perspective. But I didn't go into the field, which is a regret, because in Britain, from top to bottom and side to side, are museums and collections, big museums, small museums, public collections, full of boxes labelled boss or bison, not the skulls, because you can tell the skull.
The metatarsal bones, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Loads of skeletal bones, and they look very, very similar, and nobody's been able to tell the difference. So really, my project was to learn to tell the difference between cows and bison. In fact, the paper that came of it, I wanted to call it How to Tell the Difference Between Cows and Bison, but my advisor advised against it and had a very much longer highfalutin title. But in the Ice Age, the whole of the Northern Hemisphere was covered in bison. I mean, you couldn't move for bison. They were absolutely everywhere. They are the most, among the most common vertebrate fossils you can find.
When did they die out in England?
Oh, goodness me.
Same, probably, with the Megaloceros, I mean, the same time, 12,000 years ago?
It was probably about the same time as mammoths and Irish elk, but I think they were probably all gone by the maximum of 26,000. They're just boxes full of stuff. So I had loads and loads of material to do measurement on, and it's all in my thesis, which stays unread in Cambridge. And I never got round to writing it up, except for that one paper.
While we're talking bison, in Lascaux and Altamira, all the lovely bison that we see painted on those beautiful walls, those are the species aurochs, or the common name is aurochs?
Well, that's the funny thing. I've seen a print of a bison labelled aurochs. Is actually the name of the cow, the wild.
Okay.
It was furious. The wild progenitor of the cow, the wild progenitor of Buttercup and Daisy, is the wild ox or aurochs that lived in Europe until 1627, when the last one was shot in Poland. But the bison on the cave paintings is probably Bison Priscus.
Priscus, which we have here in Alaska. That's right. That's Blue Babe. One of the most perfect specimens is Blue Babe from
Blue
Fairbanks.
Blue
Babe is a phenomenal beast, and I've spent a lot of time staring at Blue Babe, killed by lions, and ended up in a stew that Dale ate later, but... I think what we want to do is jump forward here in time. You got your PhD at Cambridge, not too shabby, sir. But
then you
got a job at a certain magazine.
People ask me, how do you get a job at Nature? I said, well, don't ask me, because I got mine by the most peculiar set of circumstances. I was finishing off my PhD, and I decided that, paleo nerd or not, I didn't have really the kind of focus you need to be a research scientist. I was more of a writer. I was running the graduate student magazine. I was writing for the college magazine. You know, writers just can't help writing. And my PhD, I was writing like a book, which got it failed the first time. I had to go and make it more boring.
Readable.
Well, I was comforted when I read an essay by the late science fiction writer Isaac Asimov, who paid his way through college by selling science fiction to pulp magazines and learning how to be a writer. And when it came to write up his PhD, he said, I've been learning how to be a good writer for so long, I was worried I wouldn't be able to write badly enough to write my thesis. So I was writing up my thesis, and my advisor put an advert on my desk. Nature wanted an assistant editor, one of the people who handled the manuscripts. So I applied for that job and didn't get it. So one Friday, I was in the basement of the museum in Cambridge, and the phone goes, and the technician, Ray, he passed the phone to me and said, it's for you, it's the editor of Nature. So I go, cool, you know, not often people have phone calls like that. So Maddox said to me, I'm offering you a job. And this was just coming up to Christmas, so I thought, after Christmas, you know, this was a Friday, you know, coming up to Christmas, things were winding down. After Christmas, I thought maybe in the spring. He said, no, Monday at 9:30 in the morning. so I had to suddenly move there, and I was apprenticed, as it were, on a three-month contract, longest three-month contract anyone's ever had. Time is very flexible. And they said, what we want you to do is write a news story about radiological protection guidelines. And I said, who? And they said, oh, no hurry. We want 300 words by lunchtime. And so after that, I became very skilled at writing authoritatively in a great hurry about something I didn't know anything about.
Yeah, but surely you have to have some detail. Yeah. It has to pass some sort of scrutiny.
Well, don't call me Shirley. What happened was that the reason they hired me was they didn't have a writer to fulfill a contract that Maddox had made with the London Times to write a nature science story on the op-ed page of the London Times. So I was that guy.
Wow.
And this was like being picked for Manchester United after kicking a ball around on the village square. So I learned on the job how to find a story, how to write 600 words in a few hours on something I didn't know much about. So I got a Maddox. He didn't train me. He just let me get on with it and make my own mistakes. And that's how I learned, by just doing it.
I saw in one of your lectures that Nature receives around 500 submissions a week. You end up publishing 10. And you call the papers manuscripts, where here in the United States, we seem to call them papers, but you send manuscripts for approval to your colleagues, which is through emails.
Yeah.
And then it goes to referees, which are located around the world. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Can you kind of describe that process in two words or less? Ray?
I just wanted to add, yes, you know, I'm an artist, and David is an entertainer, a ventriloquist by trade. And
well, so Ray, when you're talking, it's actually David talking.
Yes, and my hand is up his, so
I can't see your right hand.
That makes me the dummy. Yes, but here, me being the dummy, I stumbled into these collaborations with scientists. I've been to art school and all that. I don't know the first thing about how the scientific process works. I don't know how professional science really even happens. And so that's what Dave and I are talking about. Like, you know, I didn't know what a paper was. Like, you know, that's something I did in high school. But how does the process?
Ray, yeah, but we know through this podcast, we've learned about the scientific submission process.
Yes, but there are certain journals. And,
yes.
And there is basically, there's science and nature, there's cell biology, but nature is, because of its impact factor, is considered the most important science journal out there. So that's the setup to the question, how does it work? If I publish my paper, I want to get my paper published, I send it to you.
But I think you have to call it a manuscript first.
Well, I can call it a manuscript here.
Tell us what the difference is. Is there any?
How does it work, Henry?
Well, really, a paper is something that's published. A manuscript is something that isn't published. It's the raw ingredients. And one of the jobs of editors is to turn one thing into the other with the guidance of the referees. So what happens is I get, just me, about 600 submissions a year. What you saw in my lecture is expanded hugely.
Right.
I mean, the team just of biologists now, when I started, was 6, and now it's nearly 20.
Wow. So this the process starts with you, Henry?
One of many editors.
Yeah,
nature.
I'm one of... The manuscripts come in, they're all submitted electronically now. They used to be submitted in the mail, but they're all electronic. And a duty editor kind of farms them out to the team, depending on their specialty. Now, I tend to... the specialties often overlap, because one of the capacities that an editor has to have is be interested in a variety, in a wide range of fields, because we often cover for each other. So I do the whole of evolutionary biology. I mean, paleontology is about half of what I do. I'm increasingly doing archaeology. We never used to do much because we're getting into the humanities. And there are a lot of really cool new methods in archaeology, but I handle general evolutionary biology and all kinds of amazing things that animals and plants do, and migration and biomechanics. So anything to do with animals and plants, evolutionary relationships, phylogeny. But also I like to help out my colleagues if they're away or on vacation, or, you know, increasingly we've had recently having to homeschool their kids during COVID. I mean, my kids have long since been able to fetch small, delicate objects unaided, so I worry about them. So I have colleagues who have been very busy. So I've taken in a lot of other stuff, all kinds of, you know, molecular biology, cell biology. It's all fantastic, and I love to learn about new things. But what happens is people send in their findings, usually quite short, a few experiments, the finding. It has to have some conceptual novelty. It mustn't just be finding the same thing by a different means. It mustn't be just confirming something that's already new. John Maddox said to me, there are no such things these days as breakthroughs, let alone major breakthroughs. Most things are an addition of one brick to a wall that's already huge. And the really important ones are two bricks at once.
Wow.
So does it make you sit up and go, wow?
That's part of the process. Like, oh my gosh, this is an extraordinary paper.
I mean, most papers or manuscripts aren't like that, of course.
Right.
And my job is to try and decide if there's some new concept that this takes beyond what's already known. So I look through the reference list, I do a bit of detective work, I look at what the other authors have done. I mean, having things like PubMed and Google Scholar these days is just phenomenal. We don't have to use our feet and go down to the library anymore. It's all there.
You said that you have an intuition. When you read, all it takes is a few paragraphs, and your intuition and years, 30 years of experience, can tell whether a paper is going to be ripe for review.
In general, yes. But of course, you know, one's intuition is never infallible. However, I've learned to trust it. And someone else asked me about this, about whether using your intuition. It's just like learning about other things. Usually your first impressions are pretty reliable. There was a psychologist called Gerd Gergerenzer who wrote a book called Gut Feeling. And he actually showed by experiments that people's gut feelings about all sorts of things are usually to be relied on.
Also called wisdom.
Well, but the problem I have when we get a manuscript, unless it's just an easy send it out to referee or easy reject it, send it to another journal, there's a grey area in between where I like to consult with my colleagues. We circulate stuff, and that happens to most of the manuscripts. But the problem I have is putting my intuition into words. Is trying to say, this is why I think this is important. You have to kind of articulate your feelings about it. That's actually part of the job I enjoy as a writer, is writing that, you know, what lawyers would call an opinion. And of course you back it up with all the references and so on. But I spend a lot of time doing that, and then we discuss things. And of course we do have our differences of opinion. Sometimes I get a manuscript which is on something that I'm really interested and close to and know a lot about compared with other things. And so I'm likely to be a bit of a fanboy, you know, really this sort of thing might be of specialist interest. And that's when I send it to my colleagues and say, hey, I might be a bit too close to this.
Somebody knows Henry's interests, and like, I maybe could snag old Henry with this one.
I've seen the first paper that I've seen citing this current book arrived on my desk today.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to say to the author, please don't cite that scurrilous reference 8. It's a secondary.
Yes,
popular
all
book.
The citations are Henry G. I think Henry.
It's usually just one, and it's usually buried, and I have to look for it.
So it sounds like you have a general consensus between your colleagues at first, and then the referees are the final.
Yeah, what are these referees? I don't get it. Can you explain that?
Well, basically, editorially, we're like any other magazine. The editors decide what we would like to see in the magazine, but we have the general interest of the reader at heart. What we're not qualified to do is judge the technical merits of it. We actually ask people at the coalface who are doing the science to look at the paper technically. The referees are working scientists, usually, and we have a database of tens and hundreds of thousands, and we're always finding more, who will, for no money...
Right, there's no money involved, but basically you need to vet these papers to make sure they are correct. So you send them to colleagues interested in and knowledgeable about the same topic.
That's right. Sometimes,
but this is also secret, so we don't know who is going to review the paper. Is that true?
It has been secret, but it doesn't have to be. People do sign their reviews. That's up to them.
And
increasingly now, if a paper is published, we will publish the referee reports and the whole correspondence to do with the file, so people can see what's done on. That's quite new. The referees can, if they will, make their identities known. But the anonymity is quite a good thing for a number of... Some people will say, I'm going to sign my reviews, whatever, which is fine. But other people, particularly if they're younger people, if they're non-tenured researchers, would like to keep their names anonymous, because quite often the paper is by someone who's very senior, who might be on their tenure committee, someone they might want to work with someday. The younger referees are the ones we want to cultivate, because they're actually doing the work. The more senior faculty spend their time at meetings, and although they often have a very grand overview, which we also need, the younger faculty pick apart papers in detail. And one reason all these people, and it's a lot of work reviewing papers for journals, but the reason people do it for free is what I call the do as you would be done by principle, because they expect that when they send their papers in, they will also be accorded that same courtesy.
Right.
And that's how it works.
It just seems that, you know, people's lives and reputations are, you know, on the line there. It can be really delicate, and people's careers can be ruined.
Oh gosh, yes.
This is
why we're trying to do it much more transparently than we used to.
It's got to be bloody rough. Emotional.
It certainly is.
Brutal, really,
and,
you know?
We have to make the decision, because referees don't always all agree. I've had a paper on my desk today where three of the referees said, no, this is terrible, and one of the referees said, it's fantastic. But of course, people's opinions differ. We don't take the majority. We sometimes overrule. Sometimes we will overrule negative referees because we think it's interesting and provocative and we'll publish it, although we're always very careful when we do that sort of thing. But what the referees do is, they inform our decision. We have a gut feeling that a paper subject to review would be one that we should like to publish. And then we get the reviews in, and then we make a decision based on the reviews. Mostly, the decision is to defer the decision. We ask the authors to revise their paper in accordance with the comments and send a revised version in. And this can go on for several rounds of review.
I imagine it could maybe go on for years sometimes, if people
It can do, but we try not to let that happen. Usually there is such a thing as flogging a dead horse. So so after a while we say, hey, lads, come on, you've had your time here. Obviously, you know, shit happens. And you know, we can't carry on this, although we write it in a more polite way. But,
Before we change subjects and get into the origins of vertebrates, has there ever been a paper that has come across your desk in the last 30 years that was an amazing scientific discovery? Basically, what is the most amazing paper that you've ever seen in your tenure at Nature?
Well, funnily enough, this is a very easy one to answer. It's the discovery of the Hobbit, the Indonesian...
Oh, right. I laughed because you're a Tolkienist.
Well,
yeah.
It wasn't the
Indonesian hominid.
Yeah, it wasn't called the Hobbit then. And part of the reason it was phenomenal was because the authors didn't know what to make of it. Because a lot of what you do as a looking at the original work is read between the lines. Now, most people have a pretty good idea, or quite often a very inflated idea, of the importance of their findings. But this group of Australian and Indonesian researchers had no idea what they'd found, because they weren't expecting to find it. It was something like dropped in from space. Mm. Now, they were looking at a fairly well-worked cave in Flores. It had been worked for decades, although it's very big and there's lots of it to dig up. And their interest was about how modern humans got to Australia, that magic land associated with Waltzing Matilda and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and kangaroos and cold lager, and Crocodile Dundee, and all these great things.
And David Strassman.
David Strassman.
David entertains in Australia.
That's where I work. I work down under.
I love Australia.
Me too.
I only went there for the first time about 3 years ago, and I could have moved there in a heartbeat. In fact, our Australian office wanted me to come and work there. And while I was in Australia, I had this separate email thread with my wife, which we call the Bruce and Sheila thread, about whether it would be feasible for us to go. And sadly not, it wasn't at the time. Oh. Anyway, be that as it may, what they didn't discover was any evidence on modern humans, but they found this very, very strange, weird, new kind of hominid that lived until fairly recent times. And what that did was throw anthropology wide open. It showed that the diversity of humans recently was much, much greater than anyone had imagined. And that was
wow,
life-changing. I mean, even more than feathered dinosaurs, which kind of people are expecting. But this little hominin had dropped in out of nowhere.
Well, wow. When the paper came in, you guys must have just been thrilled. It's like, wow. And then you keep it under wraps
It wasn't an instant hit. It was a grower. I remember sitting there reading this paper about this small-bodied hominin, thinking, you know, goodness me, in expletives, what is this? And it took me two or three reads to think, this is very strange. That's when I sent it out. I mean, a new hominin, yes, but they weren't making a fuss about it. They were
really
writing it as if they were kind of ashamed of it, as if they didn't know what to do. And in between every line was, help, what is this?
So really, you had a role in realizing the significance.
Yes, I did. And then I sent it to a wide range of referees, and almost all of them were really excited and said, this is a new species of Homo, and it's really exciting, but the authors need to make more of it, and they need to do this, that, and the other. And eventually we published the two papers in 2004, I think, and the rest is prehistory. That's the single most important discovery, in my opinion, that has come across my desk.
That's very cool.
All this time.
And actually, before we jump into the topic that I know David and I have been talking about, a topic we want to dive into with you, but has there been a spectacular mistake that you've had to retract?
That's in the lecture I watched, Ray, and he can go on for hours on that.
But
let me just summarize. There have been mistakes that they regret because we're all human, and there have been manuscripts that were passed that went to science and it was published there. And so that's just the way it is. Just the way it is. There's the attrition rate. But I think the bottom line is that 5% of all submissions are accepted out of all.
About 5 to 7. are accepted. But you know, we now have loads and loads of other journals in our portfolio of journals. So we like, contrary to popular belief, we editors do like to be nice and would like to try and find a home for your paper somewhere. I mean, most papers we get are perfectly fine. They're perfectly decent pieces of science. It's just they're not suitable for Nature because they don't have that conceptual zing, that je ne sais quoi. I don't even know what that means.
Okay, anyway, so what's that little book you're holding up there, Ray? What's that little thing
our clever segue into another topic. as you were talking about earlier with Per Aalborg and our fishy origins, and this actually leads into my question, was sometimes you as an editor maybe get to encourage science or ask for papers or even kind of steer things in a certain way. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we figured out this mysterious, what's this link between echinoderms and vertebrates? Mm-hmm. What's going on there? Most textbooks just kind of, well, we know we're a deuterostome.
It seems totally weird that we vertebrates are more closely related to echinoderms like sea stars and urchins than we are to other creatures. That's because echinoderms and vertebrates are deuterostomes, which literally means second mouth. When biologists examine the cellular embryonic stages of our lives, our anus or rear end forms before our mouth does. The same is true for sea stars, sand dollars, and icky-looking sea cucumbers. Think about that one the next time you head to the beach. First, the gut, and second is the pie hole. First is the outlet, second is the inlet. First is the egress, second is the ingress. First is the a-hole, and second is the pie hole. Deuterostomes unite.
And when I was getting tuned into my fishy origins, there was a little creature called Amphioxus. Mm. There's even a little song about Amphioxus, the sweet little lancelet that lives. Yeah. It looks like a little fish, but it has no eyes. Mm. Does have kind of a head. It's got a backbone.
And this is a fish that is extant.
It's not
today.
A fish. It's not a fish. It's between a fish. It's it's a cephalochordate, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I found it at my bed last night.
That was the severed horse's head. You really ought to look into it.
Yeah. Amphioxus, we used to think for 100 years, that's our closest relative. Then we do genome research, and we find out at the genetic level, wait a minute, we're closely related to a sea squirt, which is a weird echinoderm cousin. It's a tunicate, lives in the bottom, and it squirts out these little babies that have the hint of a backbone. Mm. We are more closely related to a sea squirt than to Amphioxus. Blew my mind. We're the spawn of, well, sea squirts, but not so much. And then I got this book, which is another book, Understanding the Origin of the Vertebrates, and my head was spinning, but then I finally got it last night. Like, oh, where evolution, sea squirts went off in this direction, but Amphioxus and creatures like Picaea kind of got off on the branch a bit. So anyways, over to you, Henry.
Sea squirts and us and Amphioxus have this little backbone-like structure called the notochord. But it's kind of soft and squishy. It's got a membrane on the outside, and it's kind of flexible. It's like one of those long, thin balloons that entertainers twist into shapes like dachshunds at parties, and they can spring back. Only they're full of fluid rather than air, and they spring back
into shape. It's a support for the nerve, correct?
It's more support for the muscles on each side, so that the animal can swim sinuously with muscles contracting and relaxing at different times and places. Now, the Amphioxus has one of these, and it has one all the way from the back to the front. But after that, tunicates and vertebrates have gone completely different ways, even though much more closely related. Now, basically, the vertebrates have become predatory. And in all parts of their life cycle, they have a notochord, and they have a gut, and they have a head, and they have a feeding apparatus. But the tunicates are the same, except they've deconstructed their life cycle. Only in their larval stage do they have the notochord, and the larva is basically a dispersal mechanism. It just uses its notochord and tail to swim to somewhere where the adult can settle. And it has a little, in its head, it just has a gravity sensing organ and an eye, which is basically a light detector. The whole point of a tunicate larva is to discover which way is down. Mm-hmm. And where it is dark.
So it's already trying to sense where it's at.
It goes down to somewhere dark and dim, and it sticks its head to the surface, and then the whole thing metamorphoses. It loses the motor cord and then becomes a feeding structure. So unlike in a vertebrate, where you have a feeding structure at one end and the motor cord and the tail at the other end, the tunicate has the same things, but at different times. Basically what
happened. Why? Why does evolution favor a change and a metamorphosis like that?
Well, it's funny. The tunicates, I think, have had the best deal because they are incredibly energy efficient. They have energy to burn. They produce. It's a very, very efficient way of doing things. And they're filter feeders. Now, there are some tunicates that remain with a notochord all their lives. There are some that don't have a notochord at all. There are some that are sexually reproducing. There's some that are hermaphrodite. There's some that are colonial. They're amazing creatures.
Henry, the larvae are both male and female. I mean, how sexual reproduction? I mean, that's what I'm wondering about. Are they just male larvae?
It's always sex with you, Ray.
No,
actually, I'm not sure if they have separate sexes. I think tunicates are, I'm not quite sure. I think they're generally hermaphrodite. And some of the tunicates have sex lives of incredible complexity. The different larval types at different times are shed in different ways.
We know at some level we are related to basically the larvae of tunicates, the larval stage of tunicates.
Well, that was the old view.
Yeah.
I think it's more general now that we are related to tunicates. Now,
We have a common ancestor, don't we? Rather than we're related to them.
At some point, the ancestor of tunicates and vertebrates would have been Amphioxus-like. It had the notochord.
Is Picaea from the Burgess Shale?
Yeah, that Picaea is a very strange creature, and it used to be thought to be very similar to the Amphioxus. That's what Steve Gould, another person who's passed, used to say. But it was originally discovered by Simon Conway Morris, who I know, and he kept not writing it up. And I asked him, Simon, I said, that's because it's his name, Simon, I said, why are you not writing up Picaea? And he said, because the more I look at it, the weirder and less Amphioxus-like it gets.
The more I look, the less I know.
Eventually he and Jean-Bernard Caron from the Royal Ontario Museum wrote up a long description. And it is kind of Amphioxus-like, but in some ways it's not. It's like a group of organisms known from China called the Yananozoans.
Which are mind-blowing,
They're a bit sort of Amphioxus. And there's another group of creatures that was found, the Vetulicolians, that look like...
I've just been digging into those, the Vetulicolians.
I'd love to see your artwork with those.
Henry, I just Googled them this morning, and I'm like going, oh, my God, they're so crazy looking.
I'd buy that T-shirt.
I defer to both of your knowledge is greater than I. What do you two think is our common ancestor in the Cambrian explosion?
It's an animal that looks something like Amphioxus.
From the fossil record.
Well, the thing is, there are no such things as ancestor-descendant relationships in the fossil record. There's only degrees of cousinhood. But this is just putting myself out on a limb here.
Okay.
On the record.
This is a podcast with amateurs.
Well, my very tentative suggestion is that the common ancestor of vertebrates and tunicates would have looked very like these creatures from the Cambrian called Vetulicolians. They had a distinct front end and back end. The front end was a blobby head with gill slits, and the back end was the notochord-supported tail. Now, as in tunicates, they basically deconstructed those two things into adult and larval stages. In vertebrates, they became integrated into a single structure. Now, the Vetulicolians are thoroughly controversial creatures, but when the first one came to... Sorry, Ray, you're saying?
I was going to say, I am enthralled with them, and I must draw them now, Henry, and they're so crazy looking, especially knowing that they might be our close kin.
Yeah, they're very, very fascinating.
And how do you spell that?
V for Victor, E for Echo, T for tango, U for umbrella, Kolian.
Vetulikolian. Yeah, your mother is a Vetulikolian.
Vetulikolian.
Yeah, she was a Vetulikolian, and your father smelt of elderberries. And what is the unladen weight of a swallow? When the paper on Vetulikolians first came into Nature, my epiphany was, this looked like a hypothetical animal that the great Alfred Sherwood Romer, a
Mr.
paleontologist,
Romer, yes.
hypothesized in one of his last papers in 1972. He said he had this animal called the somatico-visceral animal, that the vertebrate was basically two animals imperfectly merged together. Now, he said there's a kind of gut that's kind of been enveloped by a body which is basically locomotory. And you can see traces in that today, which this idea explains some weird stuff, such as the gut has a nervous system. It has as many neurons as the spinal cord, but it runs differently. It has different neurotransmitters, and it only links up to the spinal nervous system by little synapses in the body, like kind of frontier staging posts. And you can tell that the nervous system of the gut is quasi-independent every time you have food poisoning and have to rush to the lavatory because you have no conscious control of it. Also, there are some nerves in the brain, the cranial nerves, that have some weird directions. There's the vagus nerve, cranial nerve 10, I think, yes, which snakes and innervates tissues deep in the viscera, which suggests there's been some deep in the past, there's been some strange movements between the head end and the tail end. So I explain all this in Across the Bridge. So my suggestion, hypothesis, basically sitting at the bar with a pint and some peanuts idea, is that the common ancestor of vertebrates and tunicates would have looked like a Vetulikolian, but it's hard to say. That's the closest I get.
And I am inspired by that, and I want to make a segue now. Henry, have you ever seen this book, Life Story?
No, I haven't.
This is a book from, I believe, 1962 called Life Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written as a bedtime story about the history of life. It's beautifully illustrated, written and illustrated by a woman by the name of Virginia Lee Burton. Mm-hmm. She does a beautiful graphic at the front.
Isn't that lovely? I might have seen that graphic somewhere.
She's an extraordinary, but you know, I couldn't help but kind of think of your book. An extraordinary book, A Very Short History of Life on Earth.
Are you 4. Insinuating 6. Plagiarism, Ray?
No, I am not,
by
Sarah.
The editor of Nature?
I am insinuating parallel evolution.
Yeah.
It is parallel.
But all artists steal and all scientists get it from somewhere, right? But anyways, this is an extraordinary book. I love the very opening line, too, is, once upon a time, a giant star was dying. And I love the way it ends, too, not to give it all away, but the earth abides.
Mm.
Anyways, what's the origin story of this book? It is written sort of, I love the tone of it.
What book are we talking about, Ray?
We are talking about A Very Short History of Life on Earth, 4.6 billion years in 12 pithy chapters. With our guest, Henry wrote this book. Where did this come from, Henry? What's the origin story?
Well, as you know, there are all sorts of treatments about life on Earth. And my inspiration was actually the great David Attenborough, who's still with us today.
He is still with us, yes.
When I was a teenager, he did one of his great television series called Life on Earth. And it was magnificent. Nothing like it had been seen before. This was the one which he ends up talking about the gorillas. Well, sitting in front of them. And here I am, sitting, talking in front of the gorillas. And this is the origin of family life. But that was the bit that people remember. But it was the majestic sweep of the whole of life, with the most fantastic visuals and the most incredible music, and this slow, magisterial treatment. And that inspired me to get into zoology and biology, and a lot of other people, I would imagine. So in the back of my mind for years has been an idea that I'd write a little simple book called Henry's History of Life on Earth, where I just tell the story, just a narrative, starting once upon a time and going through the history of life on Earth. Now, I don't have any pictures in it. I wanted, because there are loads of other books with pictures, and I'm not a pictures kind of guy.
I was disappointed. There was so many species names that you mentioned, and I'm like, I never heard of this, and I wanted to turn the page and see it, and so I had to have Google, Dr. Google.
Well,
open.
As Ray will know, pictures are not actual fact. That there's a difference between a restoration and a recreation.
Well, you could say artist conception, couldn't you?
Yeah, but you see, the writer has an artist conception too. And, you know, I've worked with a great artist who Ray will know, called Luis Ray, on a book several years ago called A Field Guide to Dinosaurs. A publisher put me and Luis together to do it. And Luis has a very particular view about dinosaur life and dinosaur evolution. You know, Luis is a very flamboyant character, and his dinosaurs look like they're going to the fiesta. They're feathered, beautifully coloured, amazing. And I had to write to keep up with it. But we were both very clear that this book, A Field Guide to Dinosaurs, was a work of fiction, because we know actually very little about dinosaurs. And if you could get a time machine and go back to the Mesozoic, they might have looked even weirder than we can imagine. So Ray, when you're recreating a species, you've got to take a view about what you think it was like, and there's a certain amount of artistic license.
Always is, yeah.
Right.
So maybe in the future there will be a slightly longer history of life on Earth with pictures. Who knows?
Or the children's book version of it. Bedtime story.
That might also happen.
Well, I have an idea. How about you do a children's book and Ray, you illustrate it?
Well, I was thinking about that.
Let's talk.
In the UK, they made it as a kind of standard size book. But in the US, they made it at this really nice, what they call a gift size book, which is a stroke of brilliance. You could put it in an inside pocket, carry it around.
Yeah, it's nice and compact, and it reads so easily. I absolutely loved it. I love the language in it. I love the sort of sly sense of humor.
And your quotes are exquisite.
The quotes, I wrote up pages of my favorite quotes in the book, you know.
Well, read one. One of your favorites?
One of my favorite quotes, Henry, is this one toward the end. All happy, thriving species are the same. Each species facing extinction does so in its own way. And obviously, you're riffing on Tolstoy there. I love that one. But then you go on to say you actually throw in an extra billion years in the book, which I think is really great.
Yeah, so I add that for no money.
No extra money.
Three billion years.
The next billion years, what's going to happen? But you do say within the next few thousand years, Homo sapiens will have vanished. The causes will be in part the repayment of an extinction debt that is long overdue.
I love that, extinction debt.
That's pretty grim, Henry. But then you do go on to say, do not despair, the earth abides and life is living yet. But extinction debt, and have we already pulled the trigger on that?
Define it.
Yeah, what is it?
Extinction debt, some people have called it dead clade walking. And it came from a very theoretical paper that we published in Nature, I think I was the editor, in 1994, from the school of the late Bob May, and a very young theorist called Martin Nowak. It posits the idea that there are millions and millions and millions of species on the Earth, but really there are only two. There's dispersers, which when they see any sign of trouble, run away. And then there are dominant competitors, which when they get to a patch of habitat, they stay there and dominate it. And they're the ones that look the most successful. There are loads of them. They're living very happily. But in this paper called Extinction Debt, you just have to eat away at a tiny bit of habitat, and the dominant competitor, the most dominant competitor, will become extinct no matter what you do, and it will do that before the other ones that look more widespread. So it struck me.
That's because they exhaust the resources in their habitat.
Yeah, and they don't run away and do things. It struck me that these days we only live in one habitat patch. Which is the Earth, and we are the dominant competitors. And human beings sequester between 25% and 40% of all the production that plants produce. And I learned another statistic recently from a lovely new book, which is coming out soon by a man called Tom Halliday, which is also a kind of history of life on Earth, that in terms of mass, humans and domestic animals take up 96% of all the mass of all mammals, all terrestrial mammals only. So everything else, all the other giraffes and elephants and antelopes, they just squeeze into the final 4%. So we look like a dominant